nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
All right, I think I'll go ahead and start today's lecture. Lecture 10 on nano delivery of therapeutic genes and molecular biosensor feedback control systems. So this is a little bit of a follow-on from last lecture on Tuesday on drug delivery, but pointing out some of the interesting differences when you take a gene approach. So I'm going to talk first about some of the advantages and disadvantages of therapeutic genes, and then how it's a little bit easier to have either modifying control or feedback control with a gene delivery system than it is for a straight drug system. And that is one of the big advantages. We'll talk a little bit about different types of what really constitutes a therapeutic gene, and there's at least two ways we can approach that. We can take that gene delivery and we can try inserting it into the genome of the cell. But that has obviously some pretty drastic consequences, and we want to do that very carefully. Or we can just have that gene expressed typically with a plasmid-type delivery in the cytoplasm, such that I'm going to argue that that gives you a way of doing a drug delivery system. It's just another drug, basically, and it's transient, and you can turn it on and off, and it has a lot of useful things. We'll talk again a little bit more about why feedback might be a good idea to have control of, particularly in regard to some diseases. We'll talk a little bit about sensors and what those really constitute. I'll show you a number of examples, and I'll be building several molecular biosensor gene delivery systems, both from the literature and also from my own lab. And take you through some examples so you can actually see them in operation. Okay, so what we want to do then is talk, for starters, about advantages of therapeutic genes. A therapeutic gene is basically a construct that is capable of being manufactured, typically under host cell control. It also has typically control elements built into the therapeutic gene construct. In other words, it has basically a start switch, sometimes a stop switch. It has modifying regions sometimes where you can modify the expression levels. So it gives you a lot of opportunities for control. You can have on-off switches, which can be responsive to small drugs. That's typically, I'll show you some examples where things like tetracycline have been used for turning genes on or off. And then, as we said, beyond simply killing cells, if we're trying to regulate levels and deal with more chronic diseases, then we have a lot of advantages in having some kind of a negative feedback loop system that can sense the production of disease molecules and then basically knock down those disease molecules to keep them under control within a cell, and allow us to achieve a homeostasis in the body. And then I'd also like to mention that why is a nano delivery system for gene therapy a good idea? Well, first of all, we've talked about many cases where putting things into the bloodstream where they don't have high survival value. The bloodstream is designed to not have foreign things survive very well. That's part of your, in addition to a circulatory system to deliver oxygen and nutrients, it also has not only the immune system, but the ability to break down particulates and chemicals in the blood. So there's a fairly challenging set of enzymes that any system that you put in there has to survive. And so many things that work great, as I mentioned last lecture, work great in vitro, just don't work well when it comes to in vitro application or in vivo applications. So let's go a little bit further. I said that one of the things we can do is we can manufacture a dose inside the cell. And it's a little bit more obvious, I think, to most people that a therapeutic gene construct is something capable of being replicated. And so, and it knows typically either how to use the host cell machinery, as some of the gene constructs do that, and some are completely self-packaged, particularly when we take plasmid approaches. Quite often the entire construct, including all the control machinery, on-off switches, everything, are put into a very neat package. And you can manufacture these and replicate them and then use nanoparticle delivery systems to guide them in. Now, they're a little bit bigger than a small molecule, so you have to think a little bit more about that. But we are, in fact, in my lab using nanoparticle-mediated plasmid delivery actually in some plant systems right now for plant cell engineering. But it's obviously very useful for human disease. And then the other thing is that there are exquisite set of control switches that you can put inside these particularly plasmid constructs that allow you to again modify levels, to turn things on or off with external triggers. As I mentioned, if you have a tetracycline sensitive switch in your plasmid construct, then you can actually give the plasmids and then turn them on or off with, in some cases, you can put an on switch and an off switch. So you can basically turn the plasmid on or off at will, whenever you want that. So let's talk a little bit about that. So if we think about the multi-step gene delivery process, kind of like the drug delivery, the one difference is that when we take these constructs, so these packages, and put them in to a cell, they still have to go through an uptake process and get into the cytoplasm. And depending on what we do, if we're going to stably integrate them into the host genome, then we have another whole complex series of steps, and we don't want to randomly insert those genes into the host cell genome, because yes, we might express what we want to be expressed, but we may interfere with the functioning of another normal gene in the cell. And so this has led to fairly exquisite methods for highly targeted delivery to actually have insertion points in the DNA host genome, so that you put it in a very, very particular place and typically away from genes that you don't want to disturb. So there's many things that I'm not going to get into today, but you'll hear about things like zinc finger constructs, and these are ways that are quite typically used to insert at specific locations. So that's one way you can stably integrate it into the host genome. And we're going to look at a disease model, where an example where a group from Stanford has done some very nice work in terms of treating muscular dystrophy, which is obviously a body-wide disease in all the muscle mechanisms in the body. So the question is, can you actually stably express things that will actually counteract the effects of the muscular dystrophy? So that's one that I'll show you with a stable integration. And then, and that one you have to do kind of carefully. I'm going to show you that in a mouse model, but obviously doing this in humans, we've seen the effects and sometimes bad side effects of, for example, adenovirus mediated. You can think of adenovirus as a nanoparticle. It's just one by nature. Adenovirus mediated gene delivery, where we're integrating in, and there have been sometimes very bad consequences. And so human investigation committees and clinical trials are pretty strict and vigilant about any plans to stably integrate into the host genome. And usually it has to be a fatal disease, and one for which if you didn't do it, there would be no hope, for at least for many, many diseases. So a safer one, and one that I'm going to emphasize more with you in this course, is one that is expressed in the cytoplasm without integrating into the host cell genome. And in that case, it just becomes a drug manufacturing vehicle. It knows how to be able to replicate what it needs and has everything that it needs in it. And it just then produces a product which, just because it's produced in the cell doesn't mean it necessarily gets to where it wants to, where it needs to be. And so that's something that we'll talk a little bit more about. It's not quite as simple as just releasing proteins or other molecules. They may have to actually have, as part of that, some localization sequences that actually take it to a particular subregion of a cell where it needs to be. So we'll think about that a little bit. If it's not integrated, then what we want to do is think about this as another kind of drug therapy, and one which is not as seriously reviewed, if you will, certainly by human investigation committees, but also for animal work. So what constitutes a therapeutic gene? I think what we have to be pretty liberal with our definitions here. I think a therapeutic gene, first of all, is something that produces one or more molecules that either modify the expression of existing genes in the cell or produce a product, a gene product, which has the ability to modify the disease state. And when we think about this, we really have to start thinking about disease. And this is kind of a foreign concept. Think about disease as abnormal expression of genes in a single cell. Now, most diseases, when you're taught in medical school or veterinary school, you think of diseases as essentially a disease at organ level. And that certainly we tend to even teach diseases almost totally by organ level. But if you start looking deeper in that, then there has to be a cellular level expression of most diseases. And when we start doing that, we say, well, what is a disease? We'd usually describe the functioning of or dysfunctioning of an organ as a manifestation of the disease. But what causes that? If you think about the actual single cells of the organ, what causes them to act in a way that the entire organ dysfunctions? Because if we're going to take a single cell approach to disease, then we have to identify what are actually the molecular events that take place that give rise to all of the symptoms that a patient would experience, and also all of the things at tissue and organ level that actually happen that we usually characterize as the disease state. So, let's see, I think I was going to, yeah. So I'm going to go a little bit deeper and take an example of something from the recent literature, and show you an example where they actually used plasmids to act at single cell level and to actually cause, in the case, this particular disease, muscular dystrophy. They actually put a reporter gene, and these are typically fluorescent molecules that have very small number of sequences but can make a nice fluorescent product. The ones you may be most familiar with is a jellyfish protein called green fluorescent protein. And then there have been many mutations of that. So you can have almost any color you want. That was recently, the inventor of that was recently given the Nobel Prize. And so people will not only express a gene, but if they're studying this, and this is something for you to think about, in this particular case, they're doing muscular dystrophy in animals, that they can actually, as they're actually expressing this molecule, then they actually produce green fluorescent protein enough of a sequence to be a fluorescent product that then is proportional to whatever the production rate is. Now, it's interesting because green fluorescent protein comes from jellyfish, and it's relatively non-toxic unless you get into very large amounts. Now, this is something people don't think about. Sometimes if you've got a system with no feedback control and it's just sitting there and producing more and more green fluorescent protein, at some point, it can produce enough to be toxic to a cell. We tend to think of this as completely non-toxic, and that's not true. So keep that in mind. And the other nice thing is, since you can have more than one color, you can actually look at the interaction of two or more genes in a cell. Now, if you think about it, the disease model may be, it's hard to imagine most human diseases as being as simple as a single molecule production, either an overproduction typically or underproduction being responsible for a disease. It's usually going to be a set of molecules. So you may have to have, when you're studying this and or controlling it, you may have to do control two or three of these things simultaneously. But the beauty is that you can put, for example, you could put different plasmids and nanoparticle mediated plasmid delivery and actually be simultaneously affecting several genes at once. And you can, again, with each of those, you can actually look at the levels with a different color fluorescence. Green fluorescent protein, there's yellow fluorescent protein, red fluorescent protein, and actually many, many more colors. So people have done this, particularly by multicolor confocal microscopy and even multispectral confocal microscopy, to be able to separate all of the colors and also look spatially where these are being affected, because sometimes they're in different. I'm going to show you some examples here today where we actually can show the reporter gene expression and actually have it home to different parts of the cell. So this is a fairly, I'm not going to go into great detail with this to show you the specifics of this, but this is some work from the Groth and collaborators Stanford group, published in PNAS, and I'm showing you the 2000 paper where they actually made these constructs. And you'll notice that these are plasmid constructs where they have an integrase that they're putting in. This is basically a way that they're trying to deal with muscular dystrophy. And you'll notice a number of other things here. Here we have a variety of ampicillin-resistant gene regions and various types of, actually different types of antibiotic resistance. You'll see that there are cytomegalovirus, CMV, promoter. So that's something that is basically an on switch that's very easy to turn on. They can have a LAC-Z gene, which will give them some luminescent products here. There's just a wide variety, but you'll see that in general the structure is a circular construct that has typically an origin. Sometimes you'll see it as written as ORI, but that may be the start point. And then you can actually put inserts all the way around this. Now you can make plasmids of various sizes, but you can, and we've made a lot of progress in terms of making plasmids where you can literally use restriction endonucleases and insert your gene of interest in there, and in hopefully in the right order. So there are, when you can actually buy these commercially, and they'll come with all of the pieces. They'll come with insertion sites so that you can actually use restriction enzymes to snip out, like a pair of scissors, snip out a region, put your region back in, and then do a ligase to patch up the boundaries of that. So you can actually, this has become quite a sophisticated art. And then you can, the antibiotic part is typically used, to give, if you're trying to grow these things up, to give growth selection advantage, where you may, put cells, in culture. And then if they have ampicillin resistance, for example, you may treat the cells with ampicillin, and only the cells which have stably, expressed an ampicillin resistant gene will survive the growth pattern. The others will be taken out by it. So there's a large number of things that you can do, but the idea is that you don't have to do all of that yourself. There's a vast literature, there's vast commercial resources now to give you site-specific integration of your genes of interest. And many of them, again, there have been a lot of work as to how best to introduce these into cells. So here is an example that's from the same group much later, so 5 years later, all these constructs that they had made. They basically had a plasmid-mediated gene therapy for muscular dystrophy in this particular mouse model. And what they were able to do is, you notice here, they look at the actual results of this for stable expression by having the integrase put in, and what they get is an increased number of GFP labeled fibers. So they're basically counteracting the decay of muscles and producing more muscular fibers, and they can see that readily and measure it. So you can actually see that in the particular cells that they've shown labeled in here in the article that I've given you. It's a good way to be able to a nice monitoring system in an animal for being able to potentially come up with a treatment for human disease. And again, that would be in most organs of the human body that but some organs may be more important than others to treat. So that would give you a chance for selective treatment of some organs over others, either giving a local gene therapy insert on that, or a nanoparticle-mediated where it's actually targeting particular tissues and organs. Here's another one as an example for, I mentioned on the last lecture, how a lot of tumorigenesis is driven by angiogenesis, meaning that there are basically factors secreted by tumors to encourage the growth of capillaries and vasculature around there. And so one of the things you can do is you can come up with approaches to resist angiogenesis. And this particular example in this paper, what they've done is they've actually used a nanoparticle assisted gene delivery of an anti-angiogenesis factor. So it's a way to target the particular tumor cells, and I think it shows a very nice example where they actually are looking at the outcomes of this and comparing this with untreated and the amount of angiogenesis going on with naked plasma DNA and then PEG-mediated delivery systems, nanoparticle delivery systems. So this is obviously a study done human breast cancer in nude mice. So what have people done with using nanoparticles for gene delivery? The most common ones that people have done have been obviously use of viruses. Again, that viruses have evolved to have either a parasitic or synergistic interaction with human cells. So they've lived around each other for many millions of years. And so they have that pretty well worked out. The problem is that the viruses have their own agenda, and they also have the ability to replicate. And that's something that we've talked about. One thing that we're always pretty careful to do when we talk about making our synthetic virus-like nanoparticles is that synthetic nanoparticle approaches here do not have the ability to replicate themselves. So we don't have to worry about a runaway system that gets activated, because one of the things that happens with virus-based systems is that they can undergo mutations. And you might have had something which was a very safe virus delivery system, and then it undergoes mutations and becomes unsafe, and it's replicating, and you've got a lot of problems. Or you designed it to be non-replicating, and now it is able to overcome whatever barrier you put in it because of a mutation event. So for a lot of reasons, I think people are starting to shy away from virus approaches and starting to think more and more about sort of synthetic virus or nanoparticle mediated. Now, some of these nanoparticles have been around for a long time. Liposomes, that's something that's relatively easy to make, and people did that largely because they could encapsulate drugs. It's rather easy to to encapsulate traditional drugs using liposome structures. And liposomes have a lipid bilayer that lends itself to, if you get it near cells, it wants to fuse with those cells. And that gives you basically an uptake mechanism just by simple lipid fusion. It's totally a hydrophobic-driven interaction such that it wants to go, once it interacts, it wants to go inside the cell. So that's one thing that probably the greatest experience has been with liposomes. More complicated structures, dendromeres, which are essentially branched structures. The interesting thing about dendromeres is that you can create multiple regions and encapsulate different types of molecules. So people, if you want to think about it, a natural progression from liposomes, which are usually very simple structures or relatively simple structures, when you start making dendromeres, then you can have multiple different kinds of molecules in the dendromere, inside this complicated branch structure. And yet it creates microenvironments that also make it easy, so when the structure folds or unfolds, to be able to release molecules, particularly drug molecules. Polymer carriers, again, we've talked about those in terms of making charge structures, layer by layer assembly. People have done quite a bit with that. Again, the problems with that are that you can get incomplete assembly, as we mentioned, and you end up with the wrong charge, the wrong zeta potential, and then it goes to the wrong place, and you may have some problems. So as a self-assembling structure, it looks simple, but it quite often is not perfect. Magnetic nanoparticles have a lot of advantages, not only because the magnetic core provides you with a contrast agent for imaging, a way to move things around, a way to heat the structure by using an oscillating magnetic field. There's just a lot of different things, and you can make those nanoparticles over a wide range of sizes. You can make just about any size iron oxide nanoparticle that you want. Silica, also, it doesn't have some of the properties that iron has, but it's also very inert, and people, I think probably the structures that people are most popular with silica are to make mesoporous structures such that you have little nano channels, and those nano channels can be designed with mesoporous silicon to be just wide enough to allow one molecule at a time to go out through that structure. And because of that, they give a nice so-called zeroth order drug delivery. And gold nanoparticles, obviously gold can be made just about any size, from very, very small to quite large. And it's relatively inert. Okay, let's talk a little bit about molecular feedback control systems. As I said, drug delivery has traditionally not used feedback control. And when you think about designing a drug delivery system, trying to design a feedback control system to it is not a simple thing in most cases. You typically have to have the drug have some kind of secondary sites that other molecules can bind and perhaps either inactivate or activate that drug. So this might be a complicated drug structure that requires either a molecule in the cell to bind to it or not. That's typically how people would make just a straight chemically based. But it's not a simple structure to do. And therefore, there's been very little done, or comparatively little, in terms of feedback control systems with normal conventional drugs. Feedback control might seem to be a pretty good idea. I've joked at Purdue, being an engineering school, that's the first thing we teach all of our, in engineering 101, to not build systems without feedback control, because otherwise you essentially have no control over them and they can build on themselves and quickly go way out of control. So feedback control, and typically a negative feedback, you're going to have, because you want things to always require something to keep them going rather than hitting them and then having them forever thereafter just keep increasing their expression. So positive feedback controls are not normally used. And I'm going to show you some examples of that. I think a negative feedback is a safer way to do it. Just reminding you about drug delivery systems. Again, the conventional exponential decay and sometimes bi-exponential and even more complicated structures. But there really isn't much control. And if you think about then the absence of control, most of the time the drug level is too high or too low. And if we have a effective region for therapeutic response as given by this dotted line, then most of the time our drug delivery is missing it completely, and we're overexposing and causing more side effects by having high delivery, and the low end is just ineffective. So people have designed a number of things and typically with some kind of encapsulation that comes off to give so-called time release, to come off in layers. And that's becoming more and more popular. And that allows you, each time a layer comes off and essentially gives you a fresh release of drug, then you tend to oscillate around a value, and you've avoided the very high extremes and the very low extremes. It's certainly a big improvement over a straight exponential type decay. So this is relatively easy to implement, depending on to get it more and closer and closer to the dotted line represents a lot of challenges. And so this is one thing where nanotechnology really has made some big contributions, and that is with mesoporous structures and so-called nanopores to be able to give a drug delivery that can be very constant over time. So conventional drug delivery systems, this is about as good as it gets, and you can deliver relatively small molecules over a period of time. And as I said to you, the literature, particularly for things like glaucoma treatments, for pressure control, to prevent optic nerve damage, people have gotten pretty good so-called zeroth order being a straight line, drug delivery for at least 30 days. And that's pretty good, particularly if you're going to have a treatment that you require the patient to either inject it in the eye or you'd like to, you know, maybe put it on a contact lens or something like that to be able to give a flat drug delivery like this. But with the exception of that, you don't see a lot of really tight control. So the opportunity with some kind of a gene therapeutic response is that you have something which is inherently set up to target something, a disease molecule inside a cell. And that disease molecule, if it's designed to sit on a sensor switch, which is normally off. So this molecular biosensor controller is typically a negative feedback switch, which sits upstream from a gene promoter. And that's upstream from a therapeutic gene. And again, you can along in somewhere in here, you can also, add a reporter gene complex so that you can actually study that. So when you do that, you find that if this therapeutic gene product is designed to either inactivate or eliminate this disease molecule, as you eliminate it and it gets down to a low enough concentration inside the cell, then it will turn this switch off. Now, theoretically, you could make something that would survive in individual cells for a long time. And treat a chronic disease. I would indicate that nobody's done that yet, that's still a very challenging activity. So you want to think about this kind of a model. You can do this for some period of time, but probably not for a very long term. You might be able to do it for a matter of days or even a few weeks. But typically most of these things are going to be broken down at some point and stop working. So you might have to introduce more of them. I'm just saying this is a difficult thing to construct for a long-term delivery system. But it's the kind of thing, exactly the kind of thing that you'd want for most chronic diseases where you don't want to kill the cells. This is where you want to essentially push the cell into a different state And as I mentioned to you before, it sounds like it ought to be, that it's tremendously complex. How could we ever hope to do this? But in fact, people have done this reprogramming, for example, human skin cells, into induced pluripotent stem cells, with just four gene constructs. I mean, that shows the ability of cells to walk themselves once you give them a nudge in the direction from one disease state to, for example, to a normal state. Or in that particular case with induced pluripotent stem cells to make a particular type of, a cell that's needed for repair. So all of that, you want to think about that when you make a feedback control system. Okay, what is a molecular biosensor? Typically, that's going to be something, I'm going to show you some examples of that, but it's something at, man-made structures. What we're actually doing is we're putting a molecule in which typically affects the on-off state of a gene expression. And there's a lot of different things that can be done. Sometimes the molecular biosensor is as simple as putting in where a small molecule binds to it. So you have a tetracycline gene, for example, and that may cause the switch to be either thrown on or off. And as a result of that, you basically end up with an on-off switch. And you can have, as I said, both of them in the cell. You don't have to have just one. As sort of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in biology, these biosensors, you want them to sense the environment within the cell, but you want it to minimally perturb the cell's basic function. So if you have a sensor which really causes major disruptions of basic cell functions to the point where you can kill the cell or cause it to proliferate, differentiate, or do something else you don't want. So you have to make sure that you minimally perturb. And if you can do that, then you put them inside, and as we said, any kind of sensor that you're going to build is going to perturb its local environment at least a little bit. But I think what you have to do is check. And we've learned a number of techniques, typically flow and image cytometry, where we can look at cell-to-cell variations, and we can even get more elaborate and do complete gene expression profiles so we can see how much is that molecular biosensor perturbed the cell and the basic operation of that. So just be sensitive to that. It can be, some simple ones have been made, but this is a real art form, making a molecular biosensor which has no long-term disruption of the cell. Okay, so when we talk about, again, introducing why combine molecular biosensor technology with nanoparticle-mediated uptake, again, the nanoparticle, you can put a series of a very specific molecules to, first of all, protect the biosensor, which may not survive well in the bloodstream. You also have a mechanism for taking it and bringing it inside the cell. So you have all of the molecules. Remember, we're always using, when we think about a nanoparticle-mediated approach, we're taking a series of very specific molecules to do all of those very specific multi-step processes that it takes to get to basically ferry molecules from one part of the body to another, and to get them to where they need to be. So that's what you're doing, is you're really using, again, the nanoparticle, for example, mediated targeting and mediated uptake to get the biosensor to where you want it to be. And the molecular biosensor doesn't have to be inside a cell. You can also, for those of you who are interested in making, for example, larger structures which secrete, like a mesoporous nanoparticle approach which secretes drugs but gives a local concentration, you can actually build a sensor switch there to try to control based on sensing the molecules and signals given out by cells as to whether you should provide more drug or not. Particularly, for example, if you're doing repair of extracellular matrix, for example, you might want to do that. Okay, so what I'm going to do is just talk about building integrated ones, and the easiest way to show you that is to take you through several examples, and these are three examples that my lab has done over the past almost 10 years now. And what's common to all of them is this base. You've seen this many times. So here's our molecular biosensor switch. We have some kind of a gene manufacturing machinery. It can be a very simple thing. It can be a very complicated plasmid structure, for example. And we have a molecule that we're hitting. Now remember, it may be a specific disease molecule. In most cases, we don't know what those disease molecules are, but we know that maybe a cell is producing a lot of a particular protein, and we only see that as a manifestation when those cells are diseased, that we see a lot of that protein. So that gives you an idea that maybe that protein might be associated with the disease, and if you knock that down, you may cause a lot of other reactions to walk a cell again from its disease state to a more normal state. So here's your basic paradigm. And what I'm going to do is, again, show you where we have our targeted nanoparticles, seek out. I'm going to show you this for antiviral gene therapy. And I'm going to show you an example of a Trojan horse method. And remember, a Trojan horse is something that disguises itself as a natural entity, and then the cell takes it in, and then it has an agenda. So in this particular case, a Trojan horse, since many viruses, viral particles, we can make nanoparticles that look like them. And I'm going to show you an example of that with hepatitis C. So we have to have a targeting mechanism, and I'll just take you through this process. We then have to sense the pathogen, so it goes inside and says, all right, I think this cell is infected. How do I know for sure? If the cell is infected, I should see the production of certain proteins, because that would have to take place if the virus is productively infecting a cell, for example. So I could tell whether, if I get to the right place or the wrong place, it may think the cell is infected and then goes inside and says, I don't see any viral proteins, therefore I don't turn on. And if I do, you express a particular gene, and there can be I'm going to show you an example of a particular approach that we did with ribozymes. So here's a particular structure of a molecular biosensor. We made quite a number of different molecular biosensor switches to target. We have some that had transmembrane domains and cleavage regions, meaning that they would be cut by certain things inside, transactivating sequences, which would allow them to take advantage of the host cell machinery. And so one of the first things we did with sort of a Trojan horse approach to viruses is we said, well, hepatitis C, if you look at the structure of it, it has a series of proteins on the surface. It has the genome inside, but it has on the outermost part of it a protein called E2. So we said to ourselves, and this seems like a very simplistic thing, but we said, what if we made a nanoparticle roughly the size of a hepatitis C viral particle, and we coated the surface of that particle with E2 protein? That's a pretty simple approach. We just manufactured the protein and basically stuck on a layer. Well, it turns out that something pretty remarkable happens when you do that. That protein, that E2 protein, is essentially the source of how the virus uses that protein to home to various organs, particularly liver, but also to other organs. So if you actually take a nanoparticle and you put E2 protein on it, it will actually go target liver cells and other things, just about like actual normal hepatitis C virus particle will. Now, you can start letting your imagination soar at this point. You say, well, that's great. Now, if I want to go everywhere the virus goes, and I can sort of track down everywhere where the virus is likely to have gone in the body, but instead of having, unlike the hepatitis C, which has its own genome and it wants to reproduce itself, what if instead I put an antiviral inside here and come up with something that essentially that would destroy a virus? Now, you may or may not know that we have an expression that says once you're infected with the virus, you're infected for life. And that's particularly true for things like herpes viruses. You know, once you've got a mouth sore, herpes type 1, you will always have probably herpes type 1. It may not flare up sometimes, but what it'll do is it'll go hide in your nerve endings, which is why it hurts so much, because it sits right on your nerve endings. And so viruses tend to hide in the body. They can't get easily taken out. And if you tried to do that, you'd say, well, I have maybe a large number of cells infected with the virus. You really wouldn't want to kill all those cells. Because, and again, if you kill them, you might be just releasing those viruses out to neighboring cells. So you might actually be, in some cases, spreading the infection. So what if you could take a different approach, and what if you could go and pretend that you are a hepatitis C virus, go inside the cell the same way, but then have an antiviral therapy inside a single cell that can actually inactivate the virus without killing the cell? That sounds like a pretty neat idea. Well, we went and we showed that that is at least feasible. So we did a mimicry, again, biomimicry of a hepatitis C so that we could go inside. We put reporter genes on it so that we could watch what was happening inside single cells. We put a switch inside, and we found a very simple switch. We could put an emergent, and what we used tetracycline in two different ways. One case, we use it as an off switch so that we could basically throw an emergency off switch if we needed to. In another case, we used it as an on switch. So that allowed us to basically turn our construct on and off at will with just a treatment with tetracycline. Now, what we did was we used a targeted ribozyme, which has a pair of molecular scissors that looks for a very particular sequence. And in this particular one, we have it's an RNA region inside. And the particular region of sensitivity of this ribozyme was against a region called the iris region, I-R-E-S. And so what you have is essentially a binding of this ribozyme to the iris region, and then what it does is it cuts it out. And when it does that, it basically inactivates the virus. The virus is no longer able to translate. It's no longer able to replicate itself. And that's pretty neat, because that is an example of actually inactivating a virus inside a living cell without injuring the host cell. And that would be, again, there's a lot of work needs to be done, and I'm no longer actually working on that problem. We had a complex series of collaborating investigators to pull this off, and we're all in different parts of the country now. But I think what we showed was that this general approach worked quite well, and I'll show you some examples of that. So here's some examples where, so our particular hypothesis was that we could look at this. We actually had an in vitro system, which was non-trivial. It's called a HU7, human liver-derived cell line that is infectable. And that's been one of the biggest impediments, that there's very few capabilities in vitro of simulating a hepatitis C infection. So what we did was we looked for the presence of a particular protease and had it cleaved in a way that we could release it. And you can see the production here. We had two different biosensors. This is minus the biosensor and then with the biosensor. And what we have here is the different molecules. We did this with a multispectral confocal microscope where we had our transactivating sequences. We had blue in here. It's a little hard to see in here. You can look at your own slides after you download the PowerPoint. Green is the NS3 protease protein that's produced by the hepatitis C virus when there's a productive virus production going on. So what we can do is we can actually construct a switch and go in and see if we can find the cells that are infected with hepatitis C, and if we can actually shut down, because we can use the NS3 as a way of knowing, have we shut down the production, active production of the virus by monitoring the NS3 levels. And so here, you get a little bit more of an example of that. And you can see that we have a plasmid, again, with a enhanced green fluorescent protein. That's just a slightly spectrally shifted green fluorescent protein, which is more easily excited with blue light. And then basically we're seeing that we can switch that on. So these cells in green are in two different biosensor switches, one just called BS2, biosensor 2, and biosensor 3. So we compared the ability and manufactured different biosensor switches to see which ones were the best. Biosensor switch 3 was a little better than 2. And so now we combine all of that, put that in there, and then we also wanted to have a subcellular target. So we actually put in there also targeting sequences. And so that we could go to the nucleus, we could go to the endoplasmic reticulum, or we could go to various membrane structures in the cytoplasm. So we could actually guide this structure three-dimensionally. Now, we started out doing this, and we decided to put our plasmid, reporter gene plasmids for transient gene therapy into this. And we had two different colors, again, a green fluorescent protein and then a DS red reporter gene, so we could see whether we had them in one or both in the cell of interest. So we did this by traditional plasmid transfection, which a lot of people had done similar things, but we also said that we can also do this with a nanocapsule transfected. So we can put targeting molecules on this and put it into a heterogeneous structure. When people do these kinds of structures with plasma, they typically put it on a homogeneous tissue culture dish, and there's only one cell type, and they try to get a high transfection. But if you're actually going to put it in the body, you have to have a targeting mechanism. So we actually did the same kind of thing here and showed that we could target. And the interesting thing is we could target to particular cells, but we could also construct a new type of a drug system where, again, if you wanted to do error checking and make sure that you got to the right place, we could make a system that could require both constructs going to a given cell. So you can actually put sort of two halves of a drug, so-called binary drug delivery, that both halves have to be present for it to be active. So therefore, if it misdirects, you know, the probability of it going, both of them going to the wrong cell is very, very low. The probability of them going to the cell that they're actually targeted is much, much higher. So you can actually have, again, some error correction and control of that. So this is nanocapsule-mediated plasmid delivery. Okay, a second example, quite different from that. This was how I actually originally got involved in nanomedicine, working on a space radiation problem for NASA for the Mars mission. But it turns out that it has a lot of importance on the ground. And I'm going to take an example of that, where our basic idea was to come up with targeted nanoparticles, seek out radiation damaged cells, use this kind of delivery system. And we actually found, interestingly enough, that CD95, it's actually something that is a protein that is upregulated during apoptosis, but it's transiently upregulated in response to radiation doses, and interestingly enough, over a wide range of different types of radiation in an almost dose-dependent manner, meaning if you have more radiation of a particular type, you have more transient CD95 expression. So this is a way of identifying which sort of like a dosimeter on each cell, saying that it has received radiation, and it's in that zone where it's trying to decide whether to repair itself or to go into apoptosis. So we then ask ourselves with that, is the DNA damage present? Yes. And we could express a therapeutic gene or we all may also want to have a level sensitive switch saying that if there's a lot of damage present, we may not want to rescue that cell. We may want to just, if it's going to go into apoptosis on its own, we say fine. That prevents a cancer cell from being generated by this process. So it's a more complicated, you can get very complicated with a switch, but let me show you some things that we did with this. So here's an example where we had radiated cells. So and had a system where during irradiation, one of the things that happens is you end up with a antioxidant response element, which produces reactive oxygen species in the cell, or is sensitive to that. This is a molecular biosensor switch that reactive oxygen species proteins come over, sit on the switch, and turn it on or off. So if we have a cell that's been radiation damaged, and actually there's an awful lot of other, including things like spinal cord injury and so on, where reactive oxygen species are generated, you can come up with a sensor like that, which will then turn on. In this particular case, what we did was we had a particular type of DNA repair enzyme. Now, we didn't quite get to the point of doing space radiation because at that point in time, there was no space radiation on the ground facility, and it's a little hard to do that up in space. Turns out we now have a space radiation facility potentially available at Brookhaven National Lab on Long Island near New York City that actually produces radiation spectra similar to what you would get in space. So we tried something a lot simpler. We also, as I mentioned to you, space radiation was a little far away. So since we were doing this on Galveston Island and we had hundreds of thousands of college students coming down on the beaches and getting suntans and melanoma from DNA damage, we decided that we would actually attack that problem first and maybe come up with an interesting paradigm. So I'm going to show you an example where we actually came up with something that might produce useful. So radiation-sensitive biosensor switch here. First of all, ionizing radiation is a potent carcinogen. It can be toxic to cells due to oxidative stress. We plan to use the cell's own antioxidant response element to initiate the expression of foreign DNA repair. And then when activated, this ARE biosensor will drive the synthesis of our repair enzyme. So this is the basic scheme that we were trying to do. And here's an example of it where we actually made, and we simulated, we started out simulating, again, getting equivalent radiation doses is not necessarily an easy thing. So we actually cheated a little bit and made a chemical induced with this particular chemical, TBHQ, to produce reactive oxygen species inside the cell, and then came along with our system, and we had our biosensor, which then had a downstream from the biosensor switch, a green fluorescent protein reporter gene. And so you can see here in that some of these cells are producing green fluorescent protein at a pretty good rate. And then here's our just a sham sensor complex, essentially no sensor with the GFP in it. You see no GFP expression. So it's a way to test it. So if we think about assisting DNA repair, the interesting thing about DNA repair is that you have to worry about our cells are really have two totally different types of DNA. And we always think about the normal genomic DNA, but we also have mitochondrial DNA. And believe it or not, every time a cell divides, it not only divides, it's produces twice as much in copies of its nuclear DNA, but it also has to produce mitochondrial DNA. So that either of those, and there are different diseases, including mitochondrial diseases that are basically caused by DNA damage to mitochondria. So when we think about this DNA repair, we might want to include, since radiation is going to damage potentially both of them, we would want to target to the nucleus. So we'd want a target localization sequence that will take it to the nuclear region. And we also want a target localization sequence which will guide the nanoparticle over to the mitochondria. So we did both of those things. And in terms of The DNA repair, now the DNA repair could be a pretty complex thing. So we actually, again, did something a little unusual. It turned out that UV-induced damage to DNA in humans, we have only one intact repair pathway that functions in our body. Now that's actually kind of interesting because most animals have multiple ones. And it turns out when you look a little bit deeper, you find out that humans actually have a complete DNA repair path, an almost complete DNA repair pathway, but one that's missing one enzyme in the entire structure of things. It's sort of, you know, and people would ask me if there was some teleological significance to that, and I said, probably not. Probably one of our cavemen ancestors stepped out of the cave at the wrong time and got hit by a cosmic ray, and the baby was born without a without this particular enzyme. So we don't have to get too profound about how that happened, because people say, well, gee, maybe it's not supposed to be active. Maybe there's a bad thing. So, well, we proved that that's not true. And what we found, interestingly enough, was that our normal pathway, which is intact, takes a long time. It can take 24 to 36 hours to repair a cell by our intact system. But this secondary pathway, interestingly enough, when we add back one enzyme to complete the process, can do the whole DNA repair in 6 hours. So we get accelerated DNA repair. The second one, the one that was not functional, we can make it better than the original one to actually take care of the damage. So we actually did that. We did our nuclear localization signals. And you see here, it's basically an 8 amino acid sequence. For example, can go to the nucleus here. You have a little bit longer ones going to the mitochondria. And you can guide them to those two different places in the cell. And this is what happens in the top figure. And we started out testing this with simple transfection, a little bit simpler complexes. And what we found out is, as I've been telling you, that if you just sort of drop things off at the doorstep, as we say, or drop them off at the cell membrane and just don't do anything further than that, it's a big place inside a cell, and therefore they may never do anything useful. And sure enough, that's what you find. You look at that, there's almost no GFP expression in these cells that have no localization sequences. So just targeting to the cell is not good enough. You start targeting intracellularly, so you have these amino acid sequences, as in the previous slide, and what you find is that this particular one goes to the mitochondria, and you get very good localization. And this particular one, we did it with transient expression, and then we had one with stable expression for long-term repair. So we did it both ways. And so the proof ultimately is saying, okay, when we did this, how do we know that we have repaired our DNA damage? And when I do that, I look, we had two different, an in vitro system, a repair deficient human cell line, and then one which was repairable, and then took a treatment. And this is a traditional COMET assay. And for those of you not familiar with a COMET assay, you can think of each of these green dots as a cell. And you can think of whenever you see sort of the fuzzy region coming away from that looks like a COMET tail, which is why it's called a COMET assay. What that is that's pieces of DNA that have been snipped and into smaller pieces, and they're flowing out of the cell. So they're streaming away from the cell. And this says that the cell has DNA damage in it. And it will continue to do that unless you do something to actively stop it. So we can see DNA damage actually happening in cells. These cells are repair deficient. These cells are repairable. So we put these constructs into the cells. You can see there's a lot of DNA damage going on. And then 6 hours later, we basically repaired these cells. So the damage is pretty much over within 6 hours. And we can actually assay and get an idea about what percent of the cells are repaired. So we were able to successfully repair the cells in a very short period of time. Now, again, that may seem like not a particularly useful thing, but I mentioned to you that reactive oxygen species biosensors and repair of DNA damage is kind of an important concept. So one of the things that we've done is I've been working for now a number of years in glaucoma research. Most of you think of glaucoma research as the reason that you have the disease, the damage to the disease. Everybody tends to think it's the interocular pressure, the pressure inside the eye. Well, it turns out that is a very simplistic idea of what's really going on. What's really going on during glaucoma, and about 30% of people have no elevated interocular pressure. And this is interesting. Every time you have most of you are not old enough to have your eyes tested, but they'll have a little puff of air, and they basically look at the deformation of your eye to get an idea what the inside pressure is compared to what the pressure was on the outside. So it was thought that, again, elevated pressure caused the damage. And then when you start saying, well, what damage is it causing? Well, glaucoma causes damage to the optic nerve. The optic nerve is right next to the retinal region. And the optic nerve is really part of the wiring that goes between the eye and the brain. And I just came back from an interesting glaucoma national think tank. I'm on the scientific advisory board for the National Glaucoma Foundation. And we had basically a conference about this, studying about why do 30% of people have no elevated pressure but still get glaucoma? Well, it turns out that the reason that they have a problem is they have an elevated pressure above intracranial pressure. Intracranial pressure is regulated by blood pressure. So it turned out that about these 30% of people who have this problem, the biggest portion of them are very healthy, distance runner women, okay, and who are really maintaining themselves in optimal health. They have, turns out, a high risk for having glaucoma because they have very low blood pressure that lowers their intracranial pressure. They may have normal eye pressure, intraocular pressure, but their normal intraocular pressure is higher than the intracranial pressure. So it causes optic nerve damage. So when the pressure goes on the optic nerve, what it causes is reactive oxygen species generation and DNA damage. And so you basically start disintegrating the wiring between the eye and the brain. It was a very interesting conference because the people who had the people who were ophthalmologists said, "Oh yes, the brain is an extension of the eye." And the neurosurgeon said, "Oh no, the eye is an extension of the brain." And you may not think of this, but really they are all part of the same system. They're just different parts of it, but looking at the problem in different ways. So anyway, one of the things that we did, we actually were looking at it also, in addition to glaucoma causing problems with the optic nerve, it can also cause retinal damage, again, through similar mechanisms. So you have retinopathy is the particular disease. So what we made was we actually made a nanoparticle tethered antioxidant response element sensor switch, and then basically went to see if we could detect that and potentially deliver things to reduce antioxidant response activity. So again, the same principle here. Again, where we have the same antioxidant response element, one that we had for the radiation, and which we had already done, and it was an interesting secondary problem making use of that, and then going in for looking for retinopathy. So one of the first things that we did was we said, well, gee, can we wanted to be able to tether this to a magnetic nanoparticle so we could use magnetic fields and things to guide them. And we said, can you put a DNA molecule with a tethered gene sequence onto a superparamagnetic iron oxide particle and get actual production and of a gene sequence? And so what we did was we took took our reporter gene sequence and showed that we could tether it and we could put it inside. So we had a variety of tests to show that we could keep it on the nanoparticle, and then we could bring it inside, and we could produce this inside a living cell. So when you started putting this in again, testing that again on gels to show that it's really tethered to the nanoparticle and not released. And again, this one again, we've seen this multiple times, but here it is for retinopathies. Here's our molecular biosensor switch. We have our enhanced green fluorescent protein that's produced. And so this one is responding to only those cells which are undergoing reactive oxygen species stress. And then what you want to do is, and we've not gotten this far yet, then you'd want to do is come up with a strategy for a therapeutic sequence which would downregulate the production of reactive oxygen species proteins, which in turn would lower the amount of DNA damage. So your cell is sitting there trying to repair itself, but it keeps having these onslaughts caused by the reactive oxygen species, causing more DNA damage while it's busy trying to repair the previous damage. So the hope is to produce a therapeutic sequence which can effectively downregulate. And that's where we go back and we knock down that disease molecule, is the reactive oxygen species proteins, which again, indirectly are responsible for the DNA damage. So if we can knock those down, then your native DNA repair mechanisms have a chance to repair the damage. So with that, I just wanted to show you a few examples of what types of nanoparticle constructs and gene sequences you can have. And I've given you some interesting papers to show some of those, including integrating site-specific integration into cells, as well as just in the cytoplasm. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions you have. Take-home message being, think of transient gene therapy as just another drug, but one that gives you some controls that you can modify and have a little bit, like feedback controls, on-off switches, and things like that. Yes?
Does the E2 protein only target the liver when the liver is in a disease state, or the E2 protein?
Yeah, so the question is concerning the hepatitis C virus Trojan horse example that I showed you, where we had a nanoparticle of similar size to a hepatitis C, and we put that E2 protein. And so his question is, does it only attack, does a nanoparticle only attack a diseased liver? No, it because otherwise the hepatitis C wouldn't attack a healthy liver either. So it will, it's just a, the molecule is just, has a homing mechanism for not only the liver, but there are other organs in the body that are attacked by hepatitis C. So they will distribute to multiple organs. And essentially, the nice idea is that you essentially are going to go everywhere the hepatitis C virus goes, and then you carry with that nanoparticle an antiviral therapy that is hopefully capable of inactivating the virus inside a living cell so that you don't have a lot of tissue and organ damage. And sometimes it's those other organs. I mean, the liver, your liver has some ability to regenerate itself, but hepatitis C is a huge problem. And the current interferon therapy is a very, very nasty side effects, very unpleasant, and not always successful. People still die of hepatitis C, and again, you never get rid of it. You knock it down to a point, hopefully your body handles it. But excellent question. But a lot of things in the body home just by molecules. So you just got to figure out what those ones are. And those molecules do the equivalent of what we're doing with antibodies, looking for receptors on the surface. But they're simple molecules that may be a ligand receptor relationship with the molecules on the liver cells. Good question. Yes.
For the building gene approach, how should we choose between transient or like long term
Ah, okay. So her question is, if we take a gene delivery approach, how do we choose between a transient or a long term? And I would say the distinction I was making in general, the transient is typically expressed in a vector such as a plasmid, which exists pretty much by itself. You just bring it inside the cell, but it has everything that it needs in its own structure to be able to produce things. Now, you can have a more complicated one, which actually requires some of the host cell machinery but does not really integrate. But that gets more complicated as that form of transient, because quite often you'll need to interact and go to a particular part of the nucleus and interact with genes there. So you need to have something that's small enough to get through the nuclear pores, can target more or less close to where it needs to get to interact with the host cell machinery. So as my, you know, simplest way to do that is simply to use a plasmid. And I showed you all the, you know, the many plasmid constructs you can use for transient. Now, stable gene delivery implies that typically the reason stable gene delivery is usually when you actually integrate it at very particular spots into the actual host DNA, so that it becomes part of the natural DNA and will be, you know, even presumably replicated if that cell divides. So if you think about that, you would want, if you have a disease which is potentially in a lot of different, you know, it's basically throughout your body because of a gene defect of some kind, it's kind of hard to treat every cell in your body. But in fact, the only thing that makes this really feasible is that when you have a disease, even though genetic defects are in every cell in your body, you'll find that many organs, it doesn't matter at all in those organs. It only matters in some organs. And so that I think then allows you to think about doing stable gene expression in the organ that is affected by that disease, rather than trying to fix every cell in the body. That would be probably more than you'd want to do. Yeah, follow-up question? Mm-hmm.
I just don't know if you have the plasmid inside a cell, like can this one be used as a prevention way, like the plasmid stay in the cell in a way to the future that when the cell was damaged. How long the plasmid can be?
Okay, so the basic question was, if you took the plasmid approach and put them inside a cell, could you have them stay long-term inside the cell and be able to potentially, for a long period of time, prevent disease by preventing the molecules that are causing the disease from perhaps being overly expressed or whatever. And the answer is that theoretically, yes, it would be possible to do that for some period of time. But at least at this point, I don't know of any reports in the literature where people have done this more than a few days at a time. I think there have to be more elaborate strategies. Now, perhaps one of the ways to do that would be to encapsulate these structures, plasmid structures, inside a nanoparticle that protected it from, because the cell has lots of enzymes inside it too. It's not just the bloodstream, and those enzymes tend to break a lot of proteins and other molecules down. So if you put it inside a structure such that perhaps the you had some kind of a sensory feedback system, I'm not quite sure how this would be done, but that you could then secrete the product, but protect the plasmid from being destroyed, then you might be able to do that. That sounds like a worthy project. Other questions? Yes?
I have a question. If I want to design a drug delivery system with the biosensor, so which layer should I put design for the biosensor? Should the biosensor coat it outside the drug or inside the drug?
Okay, so the question basically concerned, if you want to put a biosensor in a nanoparticle system, where do you want to put it? Do you want to put it on the outside or the inside? Think about, again, in general, the answer would be you want it to be, if you think about the most innermost structures are the final structures. If you're going through a multi-step process, delayering, so the answer is you're probably going to want it inside. That also protects it more, but it also means it makes it available. So when I've made sort of schematic conceptual drawings of this earlier in the course, what I've done is I've usually drawn the biosensors near the gene delivery mechanisms or similar, and probably it would be part of that anyway. So you'd have the gene delivery and molecular biosensor switch already part of the same structure released. So you'd have to put it inside. Now that's putting, you know, a plasmid can be a pretty big thing. So depending on how big the nanoparticle is and how you encapsulated that. But it would be somewhere inside probably. Okay. Any other questions? Okay.